Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for listening to the ELL radio show, where we come to you each week on Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our hosts are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Jan Bushkai, Chuck Albright, Bill Joseph, Howard Mucci, Neil Holland, and me, Jim Hart. Before we get too far along, I want to ask you to please make a note of our telephone number, 1-213-816-1611 or 877-572-1861. Please tell your friends. We want them with us, just as you are tonight. Last week's show covered several areas of interest of our hosts. We thought this week we would bring to you a drama that unfolded in the northwest skies of America, one that is true, mysterious, and still remains unsolved. Books and movies have been written about it, and we thought we would do our own dramatization of this event that is still an ongoing investigation today. Our troupe, now known as the Eastern Playhouse Performers, will keep you in suspense until the very end of the performance. Before we get started, let's go to a commercial break.
Eastern than any other airline in the free world. If you've helped make us America's favorite way to fly, we thank you. If you haven't flown Eastern recently, give us a try. We'll show you we really do earn our wings every day.
Hey guys, good to see you all. I'll get the weather and sign the dispatch release and then bring the papers out to the airplane. You guys go ahead on out to the airplane and do the pre-flight. Looks like it's going to be a rainy all day out here in the great Pacific Northwest, but what else is new?
A gentleman in his mid-40s, wearing a suit, black trench coat, and loafers, walked up to the Northwest Airlines ticket counter at the Portland International Airport. He is carrying a black attaché case.
Good morning, sir. How may I help you?
I'd like to purchase a one-way ticket to Seattle, please.
Certainly, sir. May I have your name?
Dan Cooper, C-O-O-P-E-R. What is the amount of the fare?
Would you like first class or coach?
Coach will be fine.
Okay, that'll be $18.97. Do you have any luggage you would like to check?
Here, I have cash, $20. You can keep the change, and no, I'm carrying my attaché case with me.
Your ticket is coming through now. Let's see. It looks like you'll be in row 1B, seat C. That's one. That's 18C. Here you go. Have a nice flight, Mr. Cooper. Oh, and you'll be boarding through gate number 7B.
Mr. Dan Cooper thanks the agent and starts out to the gate for boarding flight 305 at 2:15 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. He appears to be a businessman, wearing a dark suit, neatly pressed white shirt with black tie, and a mother-of-pearl tie pin. His black trench coat is now over his left arm, with the attaché case carried in his right hand. Thus, another male passenger en route to Seattle for a business meeting.
We're ready for boarding flight 305 for Seattle, Washington. Please present your tickets to the agent at the door. Have a nice trip, and thank you for flying Northwest Orient Airlines. Oh, hello, Mr. Cooper. I work the boarding, as you can see, as well as the check-in. Enjoy your flight, please.
Good afternoon, sir. You're in seat 18C. You may store your attaché case and your coat in the overhead compartment if you like.
I'll keep both with me, unless there will be somebody occupying the seats next to me. Thank you, miss.
36 additional passengers board the plane. The flight attendants prepare the cabin for departure. The main boarding door is closed, and flight 305 taxis away from the gate at approximately 2:40 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The flight attendants go through the cabin taking drink orders.
Good afternoon again, sir. Would you like a beverage after takeoff? It's only about a 30-minute flight, so we try to get all our beverages served shortly after takeoff.
Thank you, yes. I'll have a bourbon and soda, please. May I smoke?
I'm sorry, sir. Not until we're in the air and the captain has turned off the no-smoking sign.
Captain William Scott, First Officer William Ratasak, and Second Officer A.T. Anderson are cleared to runway 28 right by the Portland Control Tower. In the cabin, Senior Flight Attendant Alice Hancock, Lauren Schaffner, Tina Mucklow buckle themselves into their assigned jump seats for departure. Lauren Schaffner takes the aft jump seat at the rear air stairs exit.
Okay, guys, we got all the checklists done. Hey, Bill, tell us how we're ready to go.
Portland Northwest 305 is ready for takeoff.
Roger, Northwest 305. You're cleared for takeoff. Wind 260 at 6 knots. Fly runway heading and contact departure on 120.5 when airborne.
Roger, clear for takeoff. Maintain runway heading and departure on 120.5.
Hey, Bill, why don't you take us to Portland and I'll fly the next leg.
The Boeing 727-100 is in position on the runway, and the first officer smoothly advances the three thrust levers to take off power. As the aircraft accelerates, the captain calls off the V1, VR, and V2 speeds as the aircraft lifts off the runway and starts its initial climb to 3,000 feet on the runway heading. Meanwhile, back in the cabin, an interesting event is about to take place.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned off the no-smoking sign, and for those who wish to do so, you're to smoke only at your seats. The lavatories, the aisles, and the galleys are no-smoking areas. Your flight attendants will be coming through the cabin with your drink orders momentarily. The fasten belt sign will remain illuminated throughout the flight, since it is only a 30-minute flight. And thank you for flying Northwest Oriental Airlines. Here you are, sir. I hope you don't mind Jack Daniels and soda. Oh, excuse me, sir. You must have dropped this piece of paper.
Yes, I think you'd better take a look at that note.
Thinking that the note was from another male passenger making a pass at her, she goes to her seat and looks at the note. It reads, "I have a bomb in my briefcase. I will use it if necessary. I want you to sit next to me. You are being hijacked. Now do exactly as I say and no one will be harmed."
May I see what you say is a bomb?
Cooper opens the attaché, and the flight attendant catches a glimpse of what appears to be a mass of wires and red-colored sticks, and demanded that she write down what he told her. Soon she was walking a new note up to the captain of the plane that demanded 4 parachutes and $200,000 in $20 bills.
Captain, we have a very serious problem in the cabin. Passenger showed me a bomb in his briefcase, and he gave me this note to bring to you.
Okay, let me read this note. It says, "I demand $200,000 in negotiable American currency and 4 parachutes. In return, I will allow 36 people to leave the aircraft when the airplane lands in Seattle. The amount will be in $20 bills and placed in small packages. And I want a fuel truck waiting to refuel the airplane. The parachute should be 2 primary and 2 reserve chutes." Florence, what is his demeanor? Is he unruly in the cabin? Is he calling any disturbance among the passengers?
No, to the contrary, Captain. He's a quiet man. He appears to be in his mid-40s, business suit, black tie, white shirt. He ordered a drink, I think it was a bourbon and soda, while the flight was waiting to take off. He's not causing any disturbance among the passengers. In fact, I suspect no one knows about his demands so far.
Well, that's good. Let's try and keep it that way, if possible. Since he hasn't demanded entrance to the flight deck, we'll also try to keep it that way also. Advise him that we will forward this request to our company in Seattle and try to have his demands met when we arrive. Let's first work on getting the passengers off the aircraft safely when we arrive, and we'll determine what his plans are after he receives the items he has requested. Now, go back and try to reassure him that we'll meet his demands as he asks for.
Flight attendant Florence Schaffner calmly leaves the flight deck and takes a seat next to Cooper. Cooper is looking out the window as the aircraft passes over the Tacoma area and comments to Schaffner.
"Looks like we're passing over Tacoma down there. I believe McCord Air Force Base is only a 20-minute drive from Seattle-Tacoma Airport. I sure would like to have another bourbon and soda. Please let me know what I owe you for my drinks. Also, when you get back up to the flight deck, tell the pilot to order meals for 6 crew members when we leave Seattle."
Okay, I'll get this to the captain and be back to let you know what he will do.
Once again, Flight Attendant Schaffner returns to the flight deck and delivers Cooper's latest demands.
Captain, this man doesn't fit the profile of a hijacker. He's too calm. He's conversant, and he even showed knowledge of where we were when we passed over Tacoma. He mentioned that McCord Air Base was only about 20 miles away from Tacoma, and he's wearing a pair of sunglasses now. Oddly enough, he seems to be enjoying the flight, and he even tried to tip me after paying for the drinks. But his bomb sure looked like the real thing when he opened that attaché case.
Hey, Florence, I just want you to know that you're doing a great job with this. Bill, how about you fly in the airplane, and I'll take care of the emergency hijacking code, the transponder, and talk to the company. Seattle Approach, this is Northwest 305, Northwest 305, and we're at our assigned altitude of 15,000 on the airway about 60 miles out. And we're squawking a special code on the transponder that I think you have picked up by now. I'll need to leave the frequency to go over to our company for further instructions, and we'll need an assigned location to hold at our present altitude.
Roger that, Northwest 305. Let us know if you need any special assistance when you land. Proceed on your present inbound to the airport and hold at Puget 15-mile DME fix. We're listening on your company frequency as well. Good luck.
Seattle operations, this is Northwest 305. Make sure you've got something to write with. We've got a very special request from a person that doesn't want to take no or will not take no as an answer.
We're ready, Captain. We were advised by ATC that you're on the emergency code. Let us know what we need to do and the demands.
Okay. First of all, we've got a very calm and deliberate hijacker on this airplane. Now, it's not your average variety. The flight attendants are doing an excellent job to this point. Now, here's what he's asking for. $200,000 in U.S. dollars and $20 denominations placed in several packages. Now, he wants four parachutes, two primary and two reserve packs. Now, have the fuel truck standing by for refueling. I'll let you know how much when we're on the ground. And, yes, he wants six meals delivered to the airplane with the items that I mentioned. Now, start this as soon as possible. We'll be holding in a holding pattern over Puget Sound area. And I'll make an announcement to the passengers that we're experiencing a mechanical problem and to avoid them knowing that a hijack is in progress on their airplane.
Got all that copied, Captain. We have the company president, Donald Nyrup, on the line now. I'll get back with you when it has been determined if all the requests can be met and how soon will be.
Okay.
Good.
I'm counting on all the requests to be met and quickly. I'll be here with this frequency open unless you want me on another for security purposes. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a small malfunction with one of our hydraulic systems. We'll be circling in an area over Puget Sound until we can resolve this issue. We're talking with our maintenance tech support in Minneapolis and should have our problem corrected soon. Now, it's not to worry, folks, as we do have backup systems and should not be a landing problem. I'll keep you informed as to our progress. Thank you for your patience.
The aircraft circled Puget Sound for approximately 2 hours to allow Seattle police and the FBI time to assemble Cooper's parachutes and ransom money and to mobilize emergency personnel. At 5:24 p.m., Cooper was informed that his demands had been met, and at 5:39 p.m., the aircraft landed at Seattle-Tacoma Airport. Cooper instructed Scott to taxi the jet to an isolated, brightly lit section of the tarmac and extinguish lights in the cabin to deter police snipers. Northwest Orient Seattle Operations Manager Al Lee approached the aircraft in street clothes to avoid the possibility that Cooper might mistake his airline uniform for that of a police officer, and delivered the cash-filled knapsack and parachutes to flight attendant Tina Mucklow via the aft stairs. Once the delivery was completed, Cooper permitted all passengers, Shatner and senior flight attendant Alice Hancock, to leave the plane.
Here are your instructions, Captain, for takeoff and when we're in the air. I want you to take up a southwest course toward Mexico City at the minimum possible airspeed without stalling the aircraft at a maximum of 10,000 feet altitude. I want the landing gear to remain deployed in the takeoff landing position. The wing flaps should be lowered to 15 degrees, and please leave the cabin unpressurized.
Mr. Cooper, the aircraft range is limited to approximately 1,000 miles under the specified conditions of flight configuration you're asking us to maintain. We'll have to make a second refueling before entering Mexico. I think we ought to refuel in Reno, Nevada. That's okay with you.
Okay, we'll refuel in Reno. I also want you to take off with the rear door open and the F-stair is deployed.
All right. Now, we're going to have to call our tech support to see what problems this will cause. It may be that we can't do this for safety and structural reasons. Anderson, give tech service a call and see if this is possible.
Never mind. I'll lower it myself once we're in flight.
Okay, I've got the company representative on the ground connection and has an FAA official asking to come aboard to speak with you. They're also telling me that they have a fuel vapor lock in the fueling truck's pumping mechanism. They've gone after another fuel truck. They have they've already loaded the meals.
It's absolutely no to the FAA coming aboard. Okay to get another fuel truck.
At approximately 7:40 p.m., the 727 took off with only Cooper, pilot Scott, flight attendant Mucklow, co-pilot Radizak, and flight engineer H.E. Anderson aboard. Two F-106 fighter aircraft scrambled from nearby McChord Air Force Base, followed behind the airliner, one above it and one below, out of Cooper's view. A Lockheed T-33 trainer, diverted from an unrelated Air National Guard mission, also shadowed the 727 until it ran low on fuel and turned back near the Oregon-California border.
Now that we're in the air, Miss, I want you to join the rest of the crew in the cockpit and remain there with the door closed.
As she complied, Mucklow observed Cooper tying something around his waist. At approximately 8 p.m., a warning light flashed in the cockpit.
Captain, I've got an aft air stair light indication on the panel. I guess he's activated the lowering of the aft air stairs. Oh, did you feel that? The cabin pressure changed.
Yeah, and I've got a quick nose pitch change. I'm going to put in some trim to regain his level flight.
Well, it looks like he's left the aircraft. He's going to get mighty wet. We've got a heavy rain cell we've been flying through.
At that moment, the aircraft was flying through a heavy rainstorm over the Lewis River in southwestern Washington. He exited at 10,000 feet at about 180 knots with the 727's gear down and flaps at 15 degrees. Since skydivers of the day exited airplanes flying at half that speed, it was assumed by some, perhaps even the FBI, that the exit itself was unsurvivable. But this is in doubt. Some parachutists have exited a 727 at speeds up to 190 knots, true airspeed. It's not necessarily pleasant at these speeds, but it's eminently survivable. At these speeds, the slipstream hits you like a hammer, but it's possible to remain relatively stable. If he was experienced in freefall, Cooper might have delayed his pull to bleed off the exit speed and deployed at terminal velocity. The NBA chute had no sleeve or deployment bag, so the opening shock would have been considerable, but hardly fatal. It would have knocked off his slip-on loafers.
Aboard the airliner, FBI agents recovered some 66 unidentified latent fingerprints, as well as Cooper's black clip-on tie and his mother-of-pearl tie clip. Also found were two of the four parachutes, one of which had been opened, and two had their shroud lines cut from the canopies. Eyewitnesses in Portland, Seattle, and Reno, and all individuals who had personally interacted with Cooper were interviewed. From these interviews, a series of composite sketches were developed. Local police and FBI agents immediately began questioning possible suspects. One of these was an Oregon man with a minor police record named D.B. Cooper. He was questioned on the off chance that the hijacker had used his real name. His involvement was quickly ruled out. However, an inexperienced wire service reporter rushing to meet an imminent deadline confused the eliminated suspect's name with the pseudonym used by the hijacker. This mistake was picked up and repeated by numerous other media sources, and the moniker D.B. Cooper became lodged in the public's collective memory.
Chuck?
A precise search area was difficult to define, as even small differences in estimate of the aircraft speed or in environmental conditions along the flight path, which vary significantly by location and altitude, change projected landing point considerably. An important variable was the length of time he remained in free fall before pulling his ripcord, if indeed succeeding in opening a parachute at all. Neither of the Air Force fighter pilots saw anything exit the airliner, either visually or on radar, nor did they see a parachute open. But at night, with extreme limited visibility, cloud cover obscuring any ground lighting below, an airborne human figure clad entirely in black clothing could easily have gone undetected. The T-33 pilot never made visual contact with the 727 at all. An experimental recreation was conducted using the same aircraft hijacked by Cooper in the same flight configuration piloted by Scott. FBI agents pushing a 200-pound sled out the open air stairs were able to reproduce the upward motion of the tail section described by the flight crew at 8:13 p.m. Based on the experiment, it was concluded that at 8:13 p.m. was the most likely jump time. And at that moment, the aircraft was flying through a heavy rainstorm over the Lewis River in southwest Washington.
Initial extrapolations placed Cooper's landing area on the southernmost outreach of Mount St. Helens, a few miles southeast of Ariel, Washington, near Lake Merwin, an artificial lake formed by a dam on the Lewis River. Search efforts focused on Clark and Cowlitz counties, encompassing the terrain immediately south and north, respectively, of the Lewis River in southwest Washington. FBI agents and sheriff deputies from those counties searched large areas of the mountainous wilderness on foot and by helicopter. Door-to-door questioning and searches of local farmhouses were also carried out. Other search parties ran patrol boats along Lake Merwin and Yale Lake, the reservoir immediately to the beach. No trace of Cooper or any of the equipment presumed to have left the aircraft with him was found. The FBI also coordinated an aerial search using fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters from the Oregon Army National Guard along the entire flight path, known as Victor 23, in standard aviation terminology, but Vector 23 in most Cooper literature, from Seattle to Reno. While numerous broken treetops and several pieces of plastic and other objects from the air resulting in the parachute canopy were sighted and investigated, nothing relevant to the hijacking was found.
In early 1972, shortly after the spring thaw, teams of FBI agents, aided by some 200 Army soldiers from Fort Lewis, along with Air Force personnel, National Guard troops, and civilian volunteers, conducted another thorough ground search of Clark and Cowlitz counties for 18 days in March, and then an additional 18 days in April. Electronic Explorations Company, a marine salvage firm, used a submarine to search the 200-foot depths of Lake Merwin. Two local women stumbled upon a skeleton in an abandoned structure in Clark County. It was later identified as the remains of a female teenager who had been abducted and murdered several weeks before. Ultimately, the search operation, arguably the most extensive and intensive in U.S. history, uncovered no significant material evidence related to the hijacking. Subsequent analysis called the original landing zone estimated into question. Scott, who was flying the aircraft manually because of Cooper's speed and altitude demands, later determined that his flight path was significantly farther east than initially assumed. Additional data from a variety of sources, in particular Continental Airlines pilot Tom Bohan, who was flying 4 minutes behind Flight 305, indicated that the wind direction factored into the drop zone calculations had really all been wrong, possibly by as much as 80 degrees. This and other supplemental data suggested that the actual drop zone was probably south-southeast of the original estimate in the drainage area of the Washougal River. I have to confess, wrote retired FBI chief investigator Ralph Himmelsbach in his 1986 book, if I were going to look for Cooper, I would head for the Washougal Valley, and its surroundings have been searched by multiple private individuals and groups in subsequent years. To date, nothing directly traceable to the hijacking has ever been found.
In late 1971, the FBI distributed lists of the ransom serial numbers to financial institutions, casinos, racetracks, and other businesses routinely conducting significant cash transactions, and to law enforcement agencies around the world. Northwest Orient offered a reward of 15% of the recovered money, up to a maximum of $25,000. In early 1972, U.S. Attorney General John Mitchell released the serial numbers to the general public. Also in 1972, two men used counterfeit $20 bills printed with Cooper serial numbers to swindle $30,000 from a Newsweek reporter named Carl Fleming in exchange for an interview with a man they falsely claimed was the hijacker. In early 1973, with the ransom money still missing, the Portland, Oregon Journal republished the serial numbers and offered $1,000 to the first person to turn in a ransom bill to the newspaper or any FBI field office. In Seattle, the Post-Intelligencer made a similar offer with a $5,000 reward. The offers remained in effect until Thanksgiving 1974, and while there were several near matches, no genuine bills were ever found. In 1975, Northwest Orient's insurer, Global Indemnity Company, complied with an order from the Minnesota Supreme Court and paid the airline's $180,000 claim on the ransom money.
In 1976, discussion arose over impending expiration of the statute of limitations on the hijacking. Most published legal analysis agreed that it would make little difference, as interpretation of the statute varies considerably from case to case and court to court. And a prosecutor could argue that Cooper had forfeited immunity on any of the several valid technical grounds. The question was rendered moot in November when a Portland grand jury returned an indictment against John Doe, also known as Dan Cooper, for air piracy and the violation of the Hobbs Act. The indictment, in effect, formally initiated prosecution of the hijacker that could be continued. Should he be apprehended any time in the future? In 1978, a placard containing instructions for lowering the aft air stairs of a 727, later verified to be from the hijacked airliner, was found by a deer hunter near a logging road about 13 miles east of Castle Rock, Washington, well north of Lake Merwin, but within the basic flight path of Flight 305.
In February 1980, an 8-year-old boy named Brian Ingram, vacationing with his father on the Columbia River about 9 miles downstream Vancouver, Washington, and 20 miles southwest of Earl, uncovered three packets of ransom cash, significantly deteriorated, but still bundled in a rubber band as he raked the sandy riverbank to build a campfire. FBI technicians confirmed that the money was indeed a portion of the ransom, two packets of $100 bills each, and a third packet of 90, all arranged in the same order as when given to Cooper. The discovery launched multiple new rounds of conjure and ultimately raised many more questions than was answered. Initial statements by investigators and scientific consultants were formed on the assumption that the bundle bills washed freely into the Columbia River from one of its many connecting tributaries. An Army Corps of Engineers hydrologist noted that the bells had disintegrated in a round fashion and were matted together, indicating they had been deposited by river action, as opposed to having been deliberately buried. If so, it confirmed that Cooper had not landed near Lake Merwin, nor any other part of Lewis River, which feeds into the Columbia, well downstream from the discovery site. It lent credence to the supplemental speculations, which we'll see later in later developments, placing the drop zone near the Wallasea River, which merges with the Columbia upstream from the discovery site.
Ultimately, the so-called free-floating hypothesis presented its own difficulties. It did not explain the 10 bills missing from one packet. There was not a logical reason that three pockets would have remained together after being separated from the rest of the money. More importantly, physical evidence was incompatible with geological evidence. Hemelbach observed that bundles floating downstream would have had to wash up on the bank within a couple of years after the hijacking because the road bands would have long since deteriorated. Geological evidence suggests that the bills remain at the area of discovery, namely a beachfront known as Tina Bar. To further confuse matters, sometime after 1974, the Corps of Engineers was dredging on that particular stretch of river. Geologist Leonard Palmer of Portland State University found two distinct layers of sand and sediment between the clay deposited on the riverbank and the layer in which the bills were buried. This would seem to indicate that the bills arrived long after dredging had been completed.
Multiple alternate theories were advanced. Some surmised that the money had been found at a distant location by someone, or possibly even a wild animal, carried to the riverbank and reburied there. There was also the possibility that the money had been found on the riverbank earlier, perhaps before the dredging, and buried in a superficial sand layer at the time. The sheriff of Calhoun County proposed that Cooper accidentally dropped a few of the bundles on the air stair, which then blew off the aircraft after he jumped and fell into the Columbia River. Bundle newspaper editor theorized that Cooper, knowing he could never spend the money, dumped it in the river, buried it there, and possibly elsewhere himself. No hypothesis offered to date satisfactorily explains all of the existing evidence. The means by which the money arrived on the riverbank remains unknown. In 1981, a human skull was unearthed along the same riverbank during excavations in search of additional evidence. Forensic pathologists eventually determined that it belonged to a woman, possibly of Native American ancestry. In 1986, after protracted negotiations, the recovered bills were divided equally between Ingram and Northwest Orient Insurer. The FBI retained 14 examples as evidence. Ingram sold 15 of his bills at auction in 2008 for about $37,000. To date, none of the approximately 9,700 remaining bills has turned up anywhere in the world. Their serial numbers remain available online for public search.
In 1988, a portion of a parachute was raised from the bottom of the same stretch of the Columbia River, but FBI experts determined that it could not have been Cooper's. In 2008, children unearthed another parachute near Amboy, Washington, about 6 miles due south of Lake Merwin, which proved to be of World War II-era military origin. The Columbia River ransom money and the air stair instruction placard remain the only bona fide physical evidence from the hijacking ever found outside of the aircraft. In late 2007, the FBI announced that a partial DNA profile had been obtained from three organic samples found on the clip-on tie left behind by the hijacker. The Bureau also made public a file of previously unreleased evidence, including Cooper's 1971 plane ticket from Portland to Seattle, price $18.52 plus tax, total of $20, paid in cash, and disclosed that Cooper chose the older of the two primary parachutes supplied to him rather than the technically superior professional sport parachute. In addition, from the two reserve parachutes given to him, Cooper selected a dummy, an unusable unit with an inoperative ripcord intended for classroom demonstrations, despite the fact that it had clear markings identifying it to any experienced skydiver as non-functional. He cannibalized the other functional reserve parachute, possibly using its shrouds to tie the money bag shut and to secure the bag to his body, as witnessed by Mucklow. The FBI stressed that inclusion of the dummy reserve parachute, one of the four obtained in haste from a Seattle skydiving school, was accidental. The agency also posted previously unreleased composite sketches and fact sheets, along with a request to the general public for information which might lead to Cooper's positive identification. Margaret.
In March 2009, the FBI disclosed that Tom Kay, a paleontologist from the Burke Museum of National History and Culture in Seattle, had assembled a team of citizen sleuths, including scientific illustrator Carol Abrazinkas and metallurgist Alan Stone. The group, now known as the Cooper Research Team, is using technology unavailable in 1971 to reinvestigate important components of the case. Using GPS and satellite imagery, they are attempting to determine if the money found by Ingram floated freely to its discovery location over time or was found elsewhere and reburied. They've re-examined 727's flight path from Seattle to Reno to more precisely estimate Cooper's landing zone. Using electron microscopy, they examine hundreds of particles on Cooper's tie, identifying lycopodium spores, likely from a pharmaceutical product, and fragments of bismuth and aluminum. In November 2011, Kay announced that particles of pure titanium had also been found on the tie. He explained that titanium, which was much rarer in the 1970s than it is today, was found at that time only in metal fabrication or production facilities or at chemical companies using it, combined with aluminum, to store extremely corrosive substances. The findings suggested, he said, that Cooper may have been a chemist or a metallurgist or may have worked in a metal or chemical manufacturing plant. Steve?
In the years since the hijacking, the FBI has periodically made public some of the working hypotheses and tentative conclusions about the case drawn from witness testimony and the scarce physical evidence. The official physical description remains unchanged and is considered reliable. Flight attendant Schaffner and Mucklow, who spent the most time with Cooper, were interviewed on the same night in separate cities and gave nearly identical descriptions. 5 feet 10 inches to 6 feet 0 inches tall, 170 to 180 pounds, mid-40s, and close-set, piercing brown eyes. Passengers and other eyewitnesses gave very similar descriptions. Agents believe that Cooper was familiar with the Seattle area and may have been an Air Force veteran, based on testimony that he recognized the city of Tacoma from the air as the jet circled Puget Sound, and his accurate comment to Mucklow that McCord Air Force Base was approximately 20 minutes driving from the Seattle-Tacoma Airport, a detail that most civilians would not know or comment upon. His financial situation was also very likely desperate. Extortionists and other criminals who steal large amounts of money nearly always do so, according to the experts, because they need it urgently. Otherwise, the crime is not worth the considerable risk. The minority opinion is that Cooper was a thrill seeker who made the jump just to prove it could be done.
Federal agents theorize that he took his alias from a popular Belgian comic book series of the 1970s featuring the fictional hero, Dan Cooper, a Royal Canadian Air Force test pilot who took part in various numerous heroic adventures, including parachuting. Because the Dan Cooper comics were never translated into English nor imported into the U.S., it was speculated that he may have encountered them during a tour of Europe. Tom Kay's Cooper Research Institute suggested another possibility, namely that Cooper was a Canadian and read these comics in Canada, where they are actually sold. His team noted that the specific demand for negotiable American currency is a phrase seldom, if ever, used by Americans. Several witnesses, however, stated that Cooper had no distinguishable accent. Still, Canada would be the most likely country of origin if he were not an American.
The FBI task force believed that Cooper was a careful and shrewd planner. He demanded four parachutes to encourage the assumption that he might compel one or more of the hostages to jump with him, thus ensuring he would not be deliberately supplied with sabotaged equipment. He chose a 727-100 aircraft because it was ideal for a bailout escape, due not only to its aft air stairs, but also the height, aftward placement of all three engines, which allowed reasonable safe jump without risk of immediate incarceration by jet exhaust. He had single-point fueling capability, a recent innovation which allowed all tanks to be refueled rapidly through a single fuel point. It also had the ability, usually for commercial jet airlines, to remain in low altitude flight without stalling. Cooper knew how to control its airspeed and altitude without entering the cockpit, where he could have been overpowered by the three pilots. In addition, Cooper was familiar with important details, such as the appropriate flap setting 15 degrees, which was unique to that aircraft, and typical refueling time. He knew that the aft air stairs could be lowered during flight, a fact never disclosed to civilian flight crews since there was no situation on a passenger flight that would make it necessary, and its operation by a single switch in the rear cabin could not be overridden by the cockpit. He may even have known particular if he served in Vietnam and had friends who did, and that the Central Intelligence Agency had been using 727s to drop agents and supplies behind enemy lines in Vietnam.
The Bureau feels strongly that he lacked crucial skydiving skills and experience. We originally thought Cooper was an experienced jumper, perhaps even a paratrooper, said Special Agent Carr, the current chief investigator. We concluded after a few years this was simply not true. No experienced parachutist would have jumped in the pitch black night in the rain with a 200 mile an hour wind in his face wearing loafers and a trench coat. It was simply too risky. He also missed that his reserve chute was only for training and had been sewn shut, something a skilled skydiver would have checked. He also failed to bring or request a helmet, chose to jump with the older and technically inferior of the two primary parachutes supplied to him, and jumped into a minus 70-degree Fahrenheit wind chill. Assuming Cooper was not a paratrooper and was an Air Force veteran, Carr believes he could have been an aircraft cargo loader. Such an assignment would have given him knowledge and experience in the aviation industry, and because Air Force loaders throw cargo out of flying aircraft, they wear emergency parachutes in case they accidentally fall out. The rudimentary jump training loaders receive would have given Cooper a working knowledge of parachutes, but not necessarily sufficient knowledge to survive the jump he made. The Bureau has argued from the beginning that Cooper did not survive his jump. Diving into the wilderness without a plan, without the right equipment, in such terrible conditions, He probably never even got his chute open, said Carr. Even if he did land safely, agents contend, survival in the mountainous terrain would have been all but impossible without an accomplice at a predetermined landing point, which would have required a precisely timed jump, necessitating, in turn, cooperation from the flight crew. There is no evidence that Cooper had any such help from the crew, nor any clear idea where he was when he jumped into the overcast darkness.
Cooper was not the first to attempt air piracy for personal gain. 2 weeks prior, Paul Cini did it aboard an Air Canada DC-8 over Montana, but was overpowered by the crew when he put his gun down to strap on the parachute. Cooper's apparent success inspired a flurry of imitators. Most copycats struck during the year that followed. Here's some examples of those. Garrett Brock Trapnell hijacked a TWA airliner en route from Los Angeles to New York City in January 1972. He demanded $306,800 in cash, the release of Angela Davis, and an audience with President Richard Nixon. After the aircraft landed at Kennedy Airport, he was shot and wounded by FBI agents before being arrested. Richard McCoy Jr., a former Army Green Beret, hijacked a United Airlines 727-100 in April after it left Denver, Colorado, diverted it to San Francisco, then bailed out over Utah with approximately $500,000 in ransom money. He landed safely but was arrested 2 days later.
Well, Margaret, some other examples are Frederick Hahnemann used a handgun to hijack an Eastern Airlines 727 in Allentown, Pennsylvania in May, demanded $303,000, and eventually parachuted into Honduras, his country of birth. A month later, with the FBI in pursuit and a $25,000 bounty on his head, he surrendered to the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa. Rob Dolan Heedy, a paratrooper and Vietnam veteran, stormed a United Airlines 727 in Reno in early June, extorted $200,000 and two parachutes, and jumped into darkness near Lake Washoe, about 25 miles south of Reno. Police found Heedy's car, sporting a United States Parachute Association bumper sticker, parked near the lake, and arrested him when he returned to it the next morning. Martin McNally, an unemployed service station attendant, used a submachine gun in late June to commandeer an American Airlines 727 en route from St. Louis to Tulsa, then diverted it eastward to Indiana and bailed out with $500,000 in ransom. McNally lost the ransom money as he exited the airplane, but landed safely near Peru, Indiana, and was apprehended a few days later in a Detroit suburb.
In all, a total of 15 hijackings, similar to Cooper's, all unsuccessful, were attempted in 1972. With the advent of universal luggage searches in 1973, the general incidence of hijackings dropped precipitously. There were no further notable Cooper imitators until July 11, 1980, when Glenn K. Tripp seized Northwest Flight 608 at Seattle-Tacoma Airport, demanding $600,000, $100,000 by an independent account, two parachutes, and the assassination of his boss. After a 10-hour standoff, he was apprehended. But on January 21, 1983, while still on probation, he made a similar attempt on the same Northwest flight and demanded to be flown to Afghanistan. When the plane landed in Portland, he was shot and killed by FBI agents. I'd like to give you the Eastern Airlines Playhouse Performers cast for tonight's show. Our announcer was Bill Joseph, Captain William Scott, Steve Thompson. D.B. Cooper was Neil Holland. First Officer William Ratzik, Chuck Albright. Second Officer H.E. Anderson is also Chuck Albright. Flight Attendant Margaret Bars in both cases. Ticket counter, me, Jim Hart. And gate agent, also me, Jim Hart. The PDX Tower, Howard Mucci. air traffic controller Howard Mucci, and station operations Herb Godfrey. This is written and produced and directed by Captain Neil Holland. Do we have some more discussion, Captain Holland?
Yes, for tonight's show, D.B. Cooper was portrayed by George Jenn. Thank you, George. And the cast, a round of applause. I think you did an outstanding job.
Well,
any discussion? I still think the D.B. Cooper has got to be one of the most discussed, mysterious, researched, whatever we want to say about the story that we just presented, which I think was a very good portrayal. And as a matter of fact, it was very accurate because the facts researched were included in our skit. So with the sound effects, we hope we created a little bit about what it might have been back when that actually occurred. And perhaps we'll get some of the callers of the original flight crew that will tell us that we did a pretty good job. We hope we did. Any other comments?
Yeah, I think that Neil did a great job of researching this, especially coming up with all of the unsuccessful attempts later on and the minute details that you uncovered concerning D.B. Cooper and where that investigation might be today as it's ongoing.
It is ongoing. We do have two callers that if you'd like to make a comment, if you would press 1 on your keyboard of your phone, then we can include you. I've opened your microphone. So area code 856, first up, who do we have on board?
Hey, it's Donna DeMarco from Bayhead, New Jersey. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, I was flying around this time. I started flying in 1969, and I flew with Eastern until its doors closed. I don't remember all these copycats that happened the years after the D.B. Cooper. And I also had a question that came to mind while I was listening to the dramatization. How did they land that 727 dragging the aft air stairs?
I believe it came off. I think that was determined in our research. I'm not certain, but it was not retracted. Well, as a matter of fact, that's a good question.
What was the question again?
I think, Chuck, you probably installed some apparatus in the aft air stair door. Would you repeat the question?
Sure. D.B. Cooper had heard the aft air stairs in order to parachute out the back of the 727. How did they land the 727 with the aft air stairs down?
Well, you can actually, after it's down, you can actually go back and pull a handle in the aft cabin area, and the door will retract. It doesn't lock down and stay that way. It's hydraulically operated up and down. Just a footnote to the general public, just to let you know, the aft air stair doors on 27s cannot go down anymore because we have installed, the maintenance people have installed what they call an air vane anti-hijacking piece there that won't let the air stairs door go down. So you don't have to worry about the doors opening in flight unless you take that air vane off. That, and they were talking about that when the agents did the drops in Vietnam, because I served in Vietnam and know that they did that. But if you don't retract the door on landing, you'll tear the door off, because one of our airplanes that I worked on at another place had a malfunction, and the door went down, and they didn't know if they could get it back up in time to land, and eventually they did land it, and the door was tore off the aircraft. So it will retract back up if you go back and operate the handle in the aft stair area.
I believe also, Chuck, is it Dorothy, our caller?
No, Donna DeMarco.
Donna, yeah. Also, the airplane is used a lot with parachute clubs in that they can load up a lot of parachutists and take the airplane aloft. And a friend of mine actually was a captain on a 727 that did a all nudist parachute drop. And Steve, you remember, and I'll tell you his name, Captain Hassan Calloway.
Was that on Eastern Airlines?
That was on Eastern. No, it wasn't on Eastern. Hassan had already retired, and he flew this trip for a jump club of nudists, which must have been very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Actually, another story was that here lately, and I think we've discussed this before, that they remotely controlled a 727, but the captain who was flying the airplane set it in motion to crash on a desert in New Mexico. He bailed out the aft air stairs, and they crashed the airplane after he bailed out. So you take that little anti-hijacking vane off the airplane, and you can lower the stairs in flight.
We do have another caller on area code 803. If you'd like to make a comment, please press 1. And if you're with us, please give us your comment. Area code 803.
All right. Thanks, but no thanks. I just called in to listen. It was a first-time thing. I'm Baron McCaskill.
Baron, thank you so much for calling in. We're glad that you listened in on our show tonight. And,
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And we hope it was entertaining and of interest to you.
It was. I'm sorry I was late. I'd like to have heard more of it, but I did enjoy it.
Thank you so much for calling. Would you like to comment further on anything? You were with Eastern. We've got plenty of time.
Yeah, I was with Eastern from 1969 until 1991. I remember that device on the aft air stairs. You would open the aft pressure bulkhead, and then the stairs would be on the right-hand side, and you would, like, push the throttle, and it would drop the stairs. But you had to call the cockpit first and ask them to disable that anti-hijacking clip. And routinely you would drop the aft air stairs when you were deplaning the passengers. It had something to do with the balance of the airplane, as I recall.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Donna, as a sidebar, when did you come with Eastern?
I started in 1969. I went to training in Miami at the Villas.
Yeah.
And I was based in Kennedy until Newark became a base in 1970, and I went over to Newark, New Jersey, and then I was there until the strike, and I was on strike for 16 months, and then when I returned, after Frank Lorenzo was no longer running the company, I refused my first recall, which would have recalled me to New York, and took my second recall to Atlanta, Georgia. And
well,
I was in Atlanta until Eastern closed its doors.
Okay. You may have flown with one of our cast members tonight, George Chen. George?
Probably we did. I don't know. I started in 70, and I left in the mid-1988.
Mid-1988. I had no idea that Eastern was ever going to run into the difficulties that they ran into. I took a mortgage on in March of 1988. I left a home in Philadelphia that I had paid off the mortgage, moved to New Jersey and built a home and took on this enormous mortgage.
Well, from
Lorenzo, well, work rules and the strike.
Yeah, yeah. From all of our cast tonight and our callers, we are into our extended time for our show tonight, but that's okay. Any further discussions by our host, our cast members? Yeah, George?
I have one question. Yes. I believe I raised it with Neil earlier today. Did the FBI or did Cooper leave behind his bomb that he allegedly had with him? Does anyone know that?
That was never brought up.
I've never heard that question raised or an answer to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if he jumped out with the money in one hand, I doubt, especially if it were a real bomb, if he would have taken that with him also.
George, my thoughts are, and I did not uncover that in my research of our skit tonight and our research that we talked about after the skit. I never saw anything that talked about the attaché case except the description of that attaché case being an old attaché, well-worn, black type color. And beyond that, there was no further discussion about what happened to it. But I would imagine that D.B. Cooper would not have exited the airplane along with the money that he had, because it was talked about that the total amount of money that he carried with him out the back of the airplane amounted to 21 pounds of bills. I don't think, and he may have had some additional, like flashlights and things like that, but I don't think that he would have carried that out the door with him. So maybe Northwest has that. I'm not sure.
Either that or he threw it out the door first.
Could have.
Well, that could be too, yeah.
You know, what I can't understand is they don't know the exact person that they're dealing with. He touched the glass. Why didn't they get fingerprints?
Well, they did. They said they did get latent prints.
Well, they should have had a very good idea who he was.
Well, apparently his prints were not on file anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, if he was ex-military, it would have been.
And I think last year or either 2011, there were some possible family members that he was an uncle or cousin of that reported that he had appeared, or come to their home and made some statements. I don't know if any of you recall that.
No.
No, I don't either.
And I think they did a documentary on that on TV.
Yeah.
And but I don't think that anything came of that, though.
Well, it still remains the mystery of aviation as far as I'm concerned. Perhaps there are other unsolved mysteries of flying and especially airline type flying, but it remains almost a folklore. Something that is talked about, and still D.B. Cooper is down in history, I guess, at this point. Jim?
Yes, sir. I'm glad we could get together tonight, and thanks to our Eastern Playhouse performers for making an interesting show of an event which occurred over 40 years ago. To our hundreds of listeners around the world, we hope you can be with us again next Monday, the same time and same place on your internet dial. Our sign-off bumper music tells me we're just about out of time for this week's show. As you know, all of our radio shows go by episode numbers, and we're about to put episode number 111 into the radio archives, where you may listen again to this episode or any of the other 110 during the past 2 years we've been broadcasting. Tell your friends about the show. More importantly, get involved with our host by participating in these broadcasts. You're welcome to participate live and on the air each Monday. We're proud of the fact that this show is the only airline company radio show of its kind. It's part, by the way, of keeping the memory of Eastern Airlines alive. We are the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Well, that's all for tonight. And from all of your hosts, we say good night, Eastern
good night.
Family
good night, everyone.
Friends.
Good night.
Good night.
Great, Jim. Good night. That was good. That was good. Ah. Oh, man. Yeah. Very good show. I hope your people listened into it.